Well, I'm really pleased to say now that I'm joined by Charles Banning, who is an author and has written a number of fantastic greyhound books. So thank you for joining us, Charles. I know you're a massive greyhound racing enthusiast. Can you start by telling me how you got into it?
Yes, well, I got into greyhound racing because I couldn't get out of it. My family had bred and trained and raced greyhounds since the early 1920s. And so I'm the third generation because it started with my grandfather and then my father followed him and then there's me.
I always think it must be such a nice childhood, you know, back then or even now for children that grow up around greyhounds all the time.
Well, we were always lucky that way because my father bred a litter of greyhounds virtually every year. So there were always puppies about. And rearing puppies is the real delight, I think, of being with greyhounds. I mean, that's the real fun. And of course, you're still, you know, optimistic. You have all the hopes because every person who breeds a greyhound breeds it so that they think they're either going to win the Greyhound Derby or they're going to win the Derby at Clonmel. It's always going to be a champion. And of course, until it races for the first time, it still is a champion as far as you're concerned. So rearing puppies is great fun. We always had puppies about. And if at any time, you know, you would have that famous child cry and I would say, well, I'm bored. And father would say, well, go and chase the puppies around. Go and make the puppies run. And so, yes, it was grand.
And did they have much success?
Yes, yes. We always had a fair measure of success. My grandfather, you know, he and his brother, Arthur, they had, you know, quite a lot of good dogs. My father was a Waterloo Cup nominator ever since the end of the Second War. So he had the right to run a dog in the Waterloo Cup every year. And although we never won it, we got to the fourth round on a couple of occasions. So as we always bred and reared and trained our dogs ourselves, that was enough for him. And it was a marvelous thing to be able to run in something like that. And we also had some good dogs on the track. We bred a very good greyhound that broke the track record at Wimbledon, called Black Barbarian, and a dog that we reared, but we didn't actually own. We reared it for a friend of ours. It was a dog back in the 70s called Demonic Gamble. He was the best British greyhound of the year of his time. He won the Gold Crest at Bristol, the Produce Stakes at Wimbledon, won a big race at Wembley. He was a great greyhound.
So you well and truly had the bug from a young age, but equally you went and got yourself a very, very good education, didn't you?
Well, yes, I was fortunate that way. So that one always had sort of various strings to one's bow. I mean, greyhounds for my grandfather and my father, they were very much their hobby. It wasn't their profession in any sort of way. Although when we had our dogs trained, because in those days we lived near Bristol. We lived just south of Bristol out in the country. And when I was growing up, Bristol had two tracks. One was the original Bristol track at Knowle, and the other track was at Eastville Stadium. And we raced dogs at both those stadiums. And our dogs in those days were trained by my uncle, Harry Sayer. And I had another uncle called Les Carpenter, who used to train at Gloucester. Uncle Les he went there in 1932 when the track opened, and he always said, they'll carry me out of here in a box. Well, they didn't quite, but I think he only ever retired for a year. So there are always, if you like, family members who are involved in dogs. And it was for my grandfather and my father, it was a hobby, but for other members of the family, it was more serious. It was a profession.
But you didn't go down that route. You went and you went to, was it Cambridge, I believe you went to?
Yes, I did. Just goes to goes to show what a university education can do for you. I spent 60 years in Greyhound. So
yeah, amazing though. You studied English literature, and that, of course, has led you down the route to becoming an author. You've got a latest book out, which we're going to talk about in depth in part two, because I've really enjoyed it, and there's lots I want to talk about with that. But you've written lots of books before. I'm sure some people watching this will have read them, including one that was called Greyhounds and the Hare, which you said went down really well, basically. Everyone absolutely loves this book. It's one I'm going to have to get my hands on.
Yes, it was a great labour of love. It was published by the National Coursing Club, for whom I worked for 20 years as its secretary and also as the keeper of the Greyhound stunt book. And the National Coursing Club was very keen to have a legacy project, which would be an inclusive history of greyhounds and greyhound sport. And so they very kindly asked me to write it for them, which I did. And it was published in September 2018. And I'm afraid all the copies have gone, which is a great shame, because people often ask me about it, ask if I've got a copy. And the answer is sadly no. No, they've all gone. It's known as the coffee table breaker, because it's so huge and so heavy that it's rumoured not only to have drowned people in the bath when they've attempted to read it there, but also broken their coffee tables as well. But there you are. The Greyhound has a very long history, so it's a very long book.
Well, I will keep an eye out on eBay for one coming up, that's for sure. But obviously, so many years in the sport, and from reading your latest book, it's certainly drummed it home to me how much the sport has changed. I mean, can you even quantify how much the sport has changed?
Yes, I mean, extraordinary, even in my own lifetime. I used to go to my first experiences of greyhound racing were at the old track at Knowle, when I used to go with my father. And that was in the early 1950s. And it was still boom time then for greyhound racing after the war. And the most remarkable crowds that you would get at a track like Knowle. And then, of course, greyhound racing was hit by two, I can only call them major disasters. One of them, of course, was the opening of betting shops. It cannot be disguised that they had the most dreadful effect on the attendances at greyhound tracks, because the great appeal of greyhound race courses to begin with was it was somewhere where a man or woman could go after work and see the dogs run, enjoy a night out, have a bet. But then, of course, with the introduction of betting offices, that particular motivation for a lot of people was gone. Although perhaps it was inevitable, it can only be said that it had, a dire effect on the live attendances of greyhound racing. I mean, I can remember in the early 1970s going to the White City to see the Derby final, and there would be 30,000 people there then.
It's unbelievable. I mean, I can't even imagine what that would be like. And I'm going back to sort of the early days of Wimbledon when I thought the crowds were big, but that's on another scale. Do you think generally the sport's changed for better or worse? Or both?
Oh dear. Well, I've got to say it. It's changed for the worse. There's no doubt about that. The amount of greyhound activity, for instance, even in the 1990s, I took over at the Greyhound Stud Book in 1988, and we were then registering almost 1,000 litters a year and probably 7,000 greyhounds a year. And of course, as this was just the United Kingdom Stud Book, so that doesn't include the dogs being bred in Ireland. So the number of greyhounds which are being bred at the moment, I'm afraid I have to say, are minuscule compared with We're only talking about 30 years ago.
And yet we have so much racing.
Yes, yes. There is that to be extremely grateful for, because I mean, I have close contacts with friends in the United States, and there in the United States, where after all greyhound racing began in 1920, in Florida, which was, if you like, the heartland of greyhound racing in the United States, from next year, I'm greyhound racing is illegal. It's banned. So that's the end of greyhound racing in Florida, where it was perhaps more popular in the United States than anywhere else, and in the country which invented it.
And I think probably here in the UK, it's fair to say that we're aware of things like that that have been happening. And one of the things that has improved and even comes across from reading your books is the welfare side, obviously, now is so strong and, you know, hoping to avoid any sort of bans. And, you know, the dogs deserve to be looked after as well, don't they?
Yes. And that, of course, is one thing which has changed enormously, and enormously for the good. And the fact that, you know, we now have a cradle-to-grave tracing system, as far as greyhounds are concerned, is a marvellous thing. The fact that we can guarantee every greyhound that runs on a race course in this country a long and happy life, it's something which we should all be grateful for. And I think, as far as the authorities are concerned, that they should be very proud of. I think that's a marvellous thing.
Well, Charles Banning is still here with me, and we're going to talk about his latest book now. It's called Please Mister. It's a substantial book, as you can see. There we go. And I have to say, I enjoyed it much more than I thought I would. I mean, the history of greyhound racing, going back as far as you've gone back, I didn't think I'd be so interested in, but how the sport has changed and progressed, it's fascinating. And all I kept thinking was, how did you find out all this stuff, and where did you get the photos from and the information from?
Well, I had a good start, because I got in contact with a chap called Timothy Sean O'Brien, who is the great-grandson of Owen Patrick Smith, who invented the electric hare and therefore actually started greyhound racing in the United States in the early 20th century. And not only did Tim provide me with all sorts of archive material, photographs, old press cuttings, but also some lovely stories from his family about his great-grandfather. And it was Tim who gave me what some people may find the rather puzzling title, Please Mister. Because the story of this is that Owen Patrick Smith have been engaged to run the major coursing meeting in America in a place called Hot Springs, South Dakota. And this was back in 1906. And OP, as he's always known to his friends, OP had set up this big coursing meeting in South Dakota. It was for the Waterloo Cup and what they call the Futurity, which was their big stake for the puppies. And he was busily watching the coursing just on the edge of the town, and he felt a little tug at his coat, and he looked down, and there was a little girl, and she said, "Please, mister," and he, like most of us, tried to ignore her, and then tug, 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 tug again, "Please, mister, do they have to kill the rabbit?" Well, that set O.P. Smith thinking. He thought, well, do we have to kill the rabbit? And after many years of experiment and in investing, you know, every last bottom dollar in his pocket in his venture, he at last produced something which meant that they didn't have to kill the rabbit. And thus he created greyhound racing.
And even the journey of that hare is amazing. There was a lady called Irene Castle involved, who was a famous dancer. She was a big influence on it as well. And the first hare, they designed to look like a hare that bobbed up and down, didn't it?
Yes. It was OP at one time had worked on trolley cars as they would call them, at the World's Fair in Chicago. And he was a man who never forgot, you know, a good idea. And the original electric hair system was, in fact, no more than a kind of miniature trolley car, which ran round the outside of the track with an artificial lure attached to it. And you can see it quite clearly, even in the early tracks in this country, in England, because the system they used at the White City and Wembley and Wimbledon when those tracks opened was the O.P. Smith system. It was his patent. But back at his original track in California, a place called Emeryville, there were an awful lot of greyhounds in California at the time because there was a lot of coursing there. And all the old Californian coursing boys, they just couldn't believe that this was going to happen. And they would come to the track with their dogs and they would say, "Well, OP, that ain't gonna work. No dog's gonna ever chase that." So we got so fed up with it, eventually he took his hanky out of his pocket and they took the dummy hair off the arm. And he put his handkerchief on the end of the lure and said, "Okay, boys, let the dog go." And of course, as you know, and I know, and everyone knows, a greyhound, a good greyhound, will chase anything. So off goes O.P. Smith's hanky around the track, and with all the dogs, of course, chasing it like billy-o. So eventually they were convinced it would work, and it did.
That said, I think there was a bit of a transitional period from what it says in your book, where so many greyhounds were used to what we call the real thing, that for a time, some of them even wore blinkers.
Yes, there's a marvellous photograph in the book of a dog wearing blinkers. They were desperately hoping that this might change their attitude. But of course, for instance, in this country, when greyhound racing started, one of the key figures in the beginning of greyhound racing was a man called Major Leslie Lyne Dixon. And Major Dixon's job was to find enough dogs so that they could actually get the track at Bellevue in Manchester started, that they'd have enough dogs to run a card. So, of course, he went round all the coursing kennels, which he knew very well because he used to judge at coursing meetings. He was a popular judge at the time. And of course, he bought up every dog he could get his hands on so that they could race at Bellevue. But of course, unfortunately, some of them weren't quite so keen on the artificial hair as they should have been. So they tried all sorts of things. And dare I say this, and of course, O.P. Smith himself had come up with another idea. This was a marketing idea more than anything else. He thought, if I can get these dogs to jump over hurdles, that will act as a great attraction as far as the crowd are concerned. And he was absolutely right. But what everyone very quickly learned in greyhound racing too was that if you had a dog which probably wasn't quite as keen on chasing the artificial hair as he should be, if there were four sets of hurdles in a race, after he jumped one, while he was just thinking about that he might have a go at the dog next to him, because the next hurdle's coming, so pop, over he goes that one. So hurdle racing had a double importance in early greyhound racing. It kept the crowds happy, and also it kept the dogs happy as well.
Which probably could still be said to be true for today as well. Yes. I think greyhound racing, sort of to the wider public, can sometimes be associated with sort of gangsters and a bit of an undercover world. And there's a really gruesome book in your photo in your book as well of Edward O'Hare dead in his car. Tell us about that one.
Yes, well, we actually put a spoiler alert when we send out when people want a book and we send them an invoice. We actually warn them about this picture. So, of course, it's always the first picture they turn to. And poor Eddie O'Hare. Eddie was a sort of shyster lawyer from St. Louis. And he got involved in, a friend of his got involved in greyhound racing very early on, about 1926. And by the end of the 1930s, he was one of the biggest men in greyhound racing. He owned tracks in Florida and St. Louis, and in Chicago, and up in New England as well. He was a very big man in greyhound racing, but he made an awful bad mistake, and that was that the man who actually owned the track in Chicago was called Alphonse Capone, a well-known gangster of the period. And Al Capone ran the Hawthorne track, and Eddie looked after it for him. Eddie made the mistake of going to the FBI and whispering to the FBI about Al Capone's tax affairs. And it was Eddie O'Hare who got Al Capone put away in Alcatraz for tax evasion, even when they couldn't get rid of him in any other way. And when Al was eventually going to be let out of Alcatraz in 1939, 1 week before they let him out of jail, he just had one score to settle, and that was Eddie O'Hare. So he had him assassinated in his car in Chicago. They made an awful mess of him.
I'm sure there's a film in this book. I'm really sure there is. another photo I wanted to touch on was the White City photo with the crowds, which you mentioned in part one of this interview. What was it like going greyhound racing when the crowds were like that? Because, you know, I obviously never saw greyhound racing in that sort of glory. Was it like being at a football match? Would that be comparable?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. It was absolutely marvellous. And you see, when I was going to the White City in the early 1970s, I was living in London at the time. It's in itself pale comparison with, say, 1930. They'd get 100,000 people to the Derby final in those days. And even when I used to go to the Greyhound, when Patricia's Hope and Yellow Printer and dogs like that were running, the whole place would feel absolutely packed out, and all the great and grand would go. I can remember at the Derby final 1 year, because it was very hot, it was in the summer as usual, and outside the restaurant they set out all these tables so that, you know, people could enjoy the fresh air and have their meal and so on, the rest of it. But what they hadn't reckoned with, of course, was that just a couple of yards beyond their tables, there were all the rest of us peering at them. So I can remember seeing Bernard Levin, you know, the famous journalist. He was a great man for the White City, watching the Derby final from his table, al fresco at the White City, and all the rest of it peering at him from 1 yard away with our pints of bitter and our hot dogs and everything.
Great, fantastic. I don't want to give too much away from the book, otherwise we won't give people a reason to buy it, but there's also some brilliant stuff about Mick the Miller and fantastic photos of him on a train and in retirement and following that dog through his career. So the book is Please Mister. I highly recommend it. If you could see it all there. Where do people get this from, Charles?
Well, they get it through my Facebook page, which is called The Greyhound and the Hare. And there's a click button at the top, and all you do is need to click that, and I will happily send you, we send you an invoice, and then you pay by PayPal, and job's done, we send you the book. Or you can get it on eBay as well.
Okay, and it's £35 delivered in the UK, and it's well worth it. It's a great coffee table book, great present for somebody that loves their greyhound racing. Nobody would fail to enjoy it. Charles Blanning, thank you so much for joining me, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I think these books will sell out pretty quick, like your last one did, to be honest.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles.
Star Sports are the proud sponsors of the English Greyhound Derby, all part of our commitment to the sport from the home of greyhound racing betting. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.